Shalom, Erev Tov, Erev Shabbat Shalom. My name is Yitzchak Et Shalom. It is now Erev Shabbat Parshat Vayetze, and I would like to share with you a few observations about the parasha in this, our weekly parasha podcast. Before going into the specific topic I'd like to explore, which is the development of a particular character in our parsha and beyond our parsha, I'd like to take a panoramic view of the parsha itself. As many have pointed out, the entire parsha is one story. It's not only one story in graphically, in that in a Sefer Torah and in a Masoretically prepared Tanakh, the entire thing is one paragraph. And it is the beginning of a paragraph, and the end of our parsha is the end of a paragraph. But indeed, the story begins with Yaakov on a journey. He encounters angels. As a result of his encounter, he changes the name of the location. As part of that encounter, he is promised protection from his enemies. And that happens both at the beginning of the parsha and at the end of the parsha. The next thing that happens in the parsha at the beginning is his encounter with Lavan and Lavan's countrymen. At the end of the parsha, when Yaakov is finally rescued, it is after or at a treaty setting with Lavan and some people who he refers to as Achei Lavan, or Achim, who are treaty signatories, with whom he makes the covenant. Interesting, at the beginning of our parsha, that covenant is sealed with stones, which are then turned into a stone that stands up as a matzeva. At the end of the parsha, Yaakov in Gilad makes a pile of stones, and that's where the treaty is signed. And there is much about the middle section of the parsha from Yaakov's beginning of his relationship with Lavan until he flees that is also structured in that way. It's an important thing to notice that it is all one story. And it's all one story because it's the story of exile. It begins with Yaakov leaving and it ends with Yaakov returning. It is a bubble in time from when Yaakov is in Israel until when Yaakov is in Israel again. Is back in Eretz Megurecha, is back in the land that he is to inherit. There's much to be said about how Yaakov understood his return to the land. Rabbi Soloveitchik once suggested that Yaakov saw himself as the embodiment and the fulfillment of the Brit Ben Amitarim. He, after all, was a stranger in a foreign land. He was oppressed very hard, at least according to his own testimony. When the fourth generation was born, because the Brit was given to Avram, so it's Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Yosef. When Yosef is born, Yaakov begins his moves, which takes 6 years, until he's able to finally return, but that's when he wants to return. He does return with great wealth, and God does indeed visit punishments, or at least judgments, on the nation or the oppressor that hurt him. That is Lavan. And so there is what to be said for that, which would have implications later on for how Yaakov and his sons would understand their presence in the land, as opposed to it being a holding pattern. Perhaps the mini exile of their history was over and it was time to begin settling in. I dealt with that in volume one of Between the Lines of the Bible. Welcome to take a look over there. But there is one particular character, that I'd like to look at, who really is the main foil throughout our parasha, and that is the character of Lavan. Lavan, as is well known in Midrashic literature, is presented in the most heinous of terms. In the famous passage that is used to introduce the Haggadah Shel Pesach, Lavan is presented as worse than Paro. Lavan wanted to kill Yaakov and all of his children, which, by the way, were Lavan's own children, own grandchildren, and as opposed to Paro, who only wanted to kill the boys. How does Lavan fare in our parsha itself? One of the interesting things that happens when we are, shall we say, reading the text via the Midrash, is that we then backread the text that way, so that when a particular character turns out to be evil, we then back read everything that he's done in such a manner. So the first time Lavan makes his appearance on the stage of history, back in Parshat Chaye Sarah, when Avram's slave came to find a wife for Yitzchak, every move that Lavan makes is judged very severely and understood to be a bit of manipulation, a bit of attempts at thievery, at deception. And so we read him throughout our parasha. The question is that really a fair picture of who the real Lavan is? And the reason I ask the question is as follows. There are several passages in our parasha, but most notably passages at the end of Parshat Toldot that seem to militate against that read. If you take a look in Parshat Toldot, in Perek Chaf Zayin, Pasuk Mem Dalet, you will see that when Rivka turns to Yaakov, after she finds out that Esav is planning to kill him, at least that's the way she understands what Esav said. Whether she understood it correctly is another thing, or whether she represented it to Yaakov correctly is another thing. She says, actually back in Pasuk Mem Gimel, V'yata v'nishma v'koli v'kum brach l'cha el Lavan achi charana, run away to Lavan, my brother. V'yashavta imo yamim achadim al ashot hashuv chamat achicha, stay with him for a while till your brother calms down, etc., etc. So Rivka, who knows Lavan, she is, after all, Lavan's sister, who knows Lavan well, who knows the household well, who grew up there, decides to send Yaakov back, and that's going to be a safe place for him. If Lavan is such a terrible person, somebody who wants to kill worse than Paro, why would Rivka entrust her beloved Yaakov to Lavan? It gets a little bit worse. Take a look at in Pasuk Chafchet, Pasuk Bet. Yitzchak, when convinced by Rivka that he has to send Yaakov away, actually she doesn't say that. Take a look at what she says. At the end of Perek Chaf Zayin, she says, "Vatom Rivka Yitzchak, katzti v'chayim nebnot chet." All she says is that Esav married local girls. If Yaakov marries a local girl, I got no reason to live. There are several solutions to that. One is the most obvious solution, which is to send some slaves with lots of money to a desirable place and find a girl who's willing to come. We have a precedent for that. After all, that's what Rivka did. And Yitzchak should be very familiar with that. Instead, what does Yitzchak do? In Pasuk Bet, Perchavche Pasuk Bet, Kumlech Paden Aram Beta V'tuel Avimecha, Kacha Misham Misham Not Lavan Achimecha. He specifically sends him to Haran and specifically tells him to take one of the daughters of Lavan. And there are really two problems in this. The first is that if Lavan is so terrible, how could Yitzchak send Yaakov there? And the second thing is, how could Yitzchak want Yaakov to take a wife who is the daughter of this Lavan? Because after all, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. How could we possibly imagine Lavan as being the worst kind of person, worse than Paro, and yet Yitzchak wants Yaakov to marry his daughter? Very bizarre thing. Now, the counter argument could be made that they didn't know who Lavan was. They had no idea who he was. They thought he was a good family member, etc. Then you've got to ask the question in the other direction, which is, what kind of parents are these who are sending their child far away, one for refuge, the other for a wife, without doing proper investigation to whom they're sending him to? So we'd have to assume that they did such an investigation. We know that there was communication back and forth between South Turkey and Canaan, between Haran and Eretz Canaan, and people knew what was going on. We get the report at the end of Parshat Vayera about the births taking place in Haran. Avraham hears about it. So there is news that goes back and forth. It's hard to believe that Lavan's reputation as an evil, conniving, deceitful guy exists. And Rivka and Yitzchak don't know about it. Very hard to believe. There is another passage inside our Parsha that also seems to militate against this read. We take a look at Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Bet. This is already after the birth of the 11 sons who are born and the one daughter who are born in Haran. And at this point, this is already after Yaakov has begun to make his money and the flock has been born in his favor. We'll talk in detail about that in a little bit. Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Bet. Vayar Yaakov et pnei Lavan, v'hinei enenu imo kidmo shelshom. He looks at Lavan, and he says, Lavan is no longer looking at him the way he used to. And then Vayomer Adonai Yaakov Shuv Al Eretz Avotecha Lo Antecha VeYemach. And then God appears to Yaakov and says, "Time to go home." So look at the chain of events. Yaakov suddenly realizes Lavan is no longer looking at him like he used to, which we will have to understand as being that no longer is Lavan favoring him or looking at him with a positive eye as he used to. Yaakov senses this. And the very next statement is, it's time to go home. Because think about this. If Lavan was always looking at Yaakov in a bad way, and now Yaakov says, oh, no longer he's looking at me in a bad way, it's a better way, why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu now telling him it's time to go home? Further than that, what happens? Vayishlach Yaakov Yikra L'Rachel Leah Hasadeh Al Tzonoh. He calls them out to the field. Vayomer Lehen, Ro'eh Anochi Ad Pnei Avichen, Hineni Like Kitmo Shel Shom. Your father is no longer looking at me like he used to. Ve'Elohei Avi Haya Imadi. And now watch what he says. Vateina Yidaten, you know, Ki V'Chol Kochi Avadti Et Avichen. He presents a litany of his, almost his complaints. Your father has changed the deal with me 10 times. We'll talk about what that means also. God has not allowed him to deal with me badly. So suddenly Yaakov is presenting Lavan in these very bad terms, but the question is, did we ever hear this earlier? And if not, what's changed? And then he describes the deal. This is referring to the different kind of spots or stripes or different kind of markings on the animals that their agreement would be, anyone's born like that would be Yaakov's, and every time they made an agreement, that was what was born. All of them. And God gave the entire flock to me. What does that mean? It's also a little bit difficult. And then he tells about the dream that he has, and that he has to go home. And then what do the girls say? Pasuk Yod Dalet, very, very instructive. Do we have a portion again in our father's house? What is it they want? What does this mean? We're considered foreigners because he sold us? He's also eaten up our money? What are they referring to? And then they say, all of the wealth that God has saved, again, what does that mean? Belongs to us and to our sons. How do their sons get into this? Are their sons meaning, of course, Bnei Yaakov? Whatever God told you, that's what you should do. This entire conversation is very bizarre. And then, of course, we come to what is probably the most bizarre and ultimately tragic component of this scene, which takes place, or the next scene, which happens when Yaakov decides that it's time to go and he takes off. Lavan is elsewhere, shearing the sheep, so we know what time of year this is. This is around June or so. And then, Pasuk Yotet, V'Lavan halach ligzoz etzono, V'atignov Rachel et hatrafim asher la'aviha. Rachel stole the household gods of her father. Why'd she do this? In the meantime, on a play on words, V'ignov Yaakov et lev Lavan arami, Ablihigi lo kivoreachu. And there's something very powerful about this. Yaakov steals the heart of Lavan, meaning that he snuck away. But notice the way it's presented. Lavan is not the thief here. Yaakov is the thief. And not only that, but Rachel is the thief, the way that it's presented in the Pasuk. Ablihigi lo asher lo kivoreachu. And then he runs away, and then, of course, later on, Lavan catches up with him, and we have the encounter. What's going on in this conversation? What's going on with the trafim? Why is Rachel taking the trafim? The answer may lie in a word that shows up in Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Aleph, but a little bit of introduction. When Yaakov first arrives in Haran, near the beginning of the parsha, after, of course, the famous night in Beit El, he encounters other people of Haran, other shepherds, and then he asks about Lavan, and they said, oh, here's Rachel Bito Ba'a Imatzon. Rachel, his daughter, we'll leave the speculation to how old she was at the time, though the implication would be that she's around 5 or 6, because the agreement is that in 7 years they'll marry, and of course girls always married in the ancient world around 12 or so. But nonetheless, Rachel is coming with its own. Where did we ever find a girl shepherding the flock? Where do you find such a thing? We find David shepherding a flock. We find Yaakov working as a shepherd. We find Avram and Lot having shepherds. It seemed to be male. We find Yaakov himself for his father being Yoshev Walim, which according to Rishonim means that he was a shepherd. Where do you find girls shepherding? There's only one place in Tanakh we're familiar with a girl shepherding, and that is the daughters of Yitro. Of course, why are they shepherding? Because there's no brothers. So that's why the girls are shepherding, and that's why they're vulnerable, and that's why the other shepherds are able to push them out of the way and take the water first, or not let them get water. And that's where Moshe comes in. Why is Rachel shepherding the flock? It's interesting, when Yaakov arrives, Lavan immediately takes him in. And what does Lavan do? He takes him in and he says, Hachi achiata, after all, you're my brother, you're my kinsman. Vavatani chinam, you're not going to work for me for nothing. What is your fee? What was Lavan looking for? It's interesting, we have unearthed in the last 150 years lots and lots and lots of records from the ancient world, including from the period of Devot and including from this neck of the woods, including letters, including contracts, including laws, including poetry, all sorts of things. And that includes contracts made between ranchers and herdsmen, people who owned flock and people who would tend the flock and graze the flock for them. And these contracts look suspiciously like some of the interaction between Yaakov and Lavan, especially at the end of the parsha, where Yaakov presents his complaint, his challenge, his claim to Lavan, and he presents his own work detail of how hard he would work, and working at night, and working during the day, and if a trefa was found, he would make it up. Anochi ichatana. And among these contracts, we also find contracts in which a rancher who did not have a son would hire a herdsman but would adopt him into his family. Interestingly, in some of these cases, the rancher would adopt the herdsman into the family, and the contract would be written. We have a particular contract like this. The contract would stipulate that if the rancher has no sons ever, then this fellow becomes his son, inherits the estate, and along with the estate, he inherits the household gods, we refer to as trafim, which evidently, at least in some contexts, was a marker of ownership in the family, of having a portion, or the chief portion, in leadership of the family. Kind of like a scepter might be. Now, if on the other hand, the contract goes on, the rancher eventually does have children, then this herdsman will remain part of the family, will inherit with the family, but the other son, the real biological son, will get the household gods. All right. Now, take a look at Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, and lots of things will become clear. Who speaks up and complains in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Aleph? B'nei Lavan, Lavan's sons. Where were B'nei Lavan? We've never heard of them before. Up until now, we've had Lavan, we've had all sorts of kinsmen around, we've had Rachel, we've had Leah, we've had Yaakov, and then their children. There are no B'nai Lavan. Who are these B'nai Lavan? Who are these sons? And what's the claim they make? Listen to their claim. Yaakov has taken everything of our fathers. What they're really saying, of course, is Yaakov is eating into our inheritance. Now notice, by the way, that this is after 6 years of Yaakov working for Lavan, not for daughters, but for sheep and for profit. Now, when Yaakov came to Lavan, Lavan's question to him was, Ma maskurtecha, what's your fee? We have a number of contracts of this sort of relationship, and the fee normally was a particular percentage of the profits of the shearing, or a particular percentage of the sheep. Yaakov kind of throws a curveball and instead says, I'll marry Rachel. I'll work for you for 7 years in for Rachel's hand. Lavan has just scored a coup because he has a herdsman who it's going to turn out is be a very reliable herdsman. He doesn't have to pay him anything, and now he's going to get his daughter married off without having to pay a dowry, which was customary throughout the ancient world. What was the purpose of the dowry? The dowry was, as somebody once noted, a pre-mortem guarantee on inheritance. That before father died, he gave, and it's the way Gemara and Ketubot deals with it, he gave his daughter a particular piece of property or of goods that would be guarantee for her and for her own children. And that leads to the takana of Ketubat Panim Dichrin, that if a woman brings a particular sum into the marriage, Ketuvat Panim Dichrin militates that that section, that piece of the estate, must be divided with only among her children only. So if there are multiple wives, only her children gets it. Because after all, her father gave her that money for his own grandchildren, not for somebody else's. Now, Lavan now has, as I said, a coup. He's got Yaakov working for him. He now doesn't have to pay him. And not only that, but he gets to marry Rachel off without having to give a dowry. What happens, perhaps, surprise, surprise, after 7 years, Leah is unexpectedly unmarried. So Lavan simply follows normal local custom. And he says that to Yaakov. And there's something of a needle to Yaakov. When Yaakov wakes up in the morning and says, why did you give me Leah? He says, what are you talking about? Leah sechen mimkomeinu. That's not what we do in our place, to have the younger marry marry for the older. And Chazal pick up on that. Leah sechen mimkomeinu. Maybe you and Khan, you steal brachot from your older brothers. We don't do that here. We have respect for age order. But there's another piece of the puzzle. Yaakov, you've been here 7 years. Don't you know the local customs? Haven't been paying attention? You know how we do things here. And so, and by the way, Yaakov does not protest after Lavan says that. He accepts it. He works another week, marries Rachel, and then works another 7 years to pay off for Rachel. All right, very good. But now, at the end of the 14 years, Lavan really is sort of stuck because he wants to continue the contract with Yaakov, but the girls have been paid off, as it were, paid up. And so now he wants to continue in this relationship. Remember, at the beginning of the 20 years of Yaakov's sojourn with Lavan, there were no sons. So Lavan was very likely looking at Yaakov as his son and adopting him as a son. And then things actually could turn out to be quite perfect because he's going to marry Leah, he's going to marry Rachel, so his two daughters are going to be married to this guy. All the children and the grandchildren are all going to stay in the property. And now Yaakov turns to him after the 14 years and says, now I've got to make money for my own household. Lavan is happy to make the contract. And they make the contract. What does the contract read? All the spotted go to you. If you find a spotted one in my flock, then it's stolen. Lavan is fine with that. They write a contract. We have such contracts. And these contracts were rewritten every year after the shearing of the sheep. So for Lavan to have changed the contract every year was perfectly normal and perfectly acceptable. Lavan, at this point, is not a bad guy. He's doing what the proper economic thing. Perhaps he's taking advantage of it. But he's not doing anything deceitful, and certainly not doing anything wrong. And every year they write a new contract. But the nace is, of course, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets involved and makes sure that whatever Yaakov has agreed to in the contract, that's what's going to be born in the flock. Now, from some of the records that we have, flocks in that part of the world at that point in history turned over every 6 or 6.5 years, which means that after 6 years, there were no more living sheep from the original group. So what happens? The first year of the contract, let's say that Yaakov is going to get all the spotted sheep and all spotted goats. What happens? Everything newborn is spotted. So all the newborns are his, but there's still a lot that Lavan has. But by the time 6 years come, the whole kit and caboodle, that was Yaakov's. Because every year, whatever the contract has been, that's how God has favored him, and that's what's been born. So you understand that now suddenly, at a later point, Lavan had had sons. Somewhere after Yaakov came to the place, Lavan had sons. These sons turn around, and what do they say? Yaakov has stolen everything of our fathers, meaning, he has taken everything of our fathers, meaning, we are being drained, and we will have no inheritance. In the meantime, they, of course, have sway with Lavan. So Lavan is now looking at Yaakov very differently than he used to. He's not looking at him favorably, like his son. Suddenly, his own biological children are giving him a lot of tzaras, a lot of problems, a lot of heartache about the fact that this interloper has now taken everything. And so Lavan is looking at him a different way. Yaakov comes to his wives and tells them the story, and what's their reaction? Yes, indeed, father sold us down the line. We never got a dowry. We were never properly married. We were married off for work, but we weren't given a dowry. And all of the wealth that God gave to you really belongs to us. In other words, all of that really should have come to us as a dowry. and Livanenu, because what's the point of a dowry? For their own children. And so therefore they said, and so God has saved us, saved that money and brought it to us via this continual contract change that happens. Now by this point, of course, Lavan is very sour, and Lavan is an enemy. But Lavan is an enemy because of the new players on the stage who are mentioned only once, Bnei Lavan. But their presence changes everything. From Perek Lamed Aleph on, the relationship between Yaakov and Lavan, that if you look very carefully until that point, was positive, was friendly, was cooperative, was good. So, and with the one possible exception of the switch of marriage, but that's not necessarily to be read in Lavan's disfavor. Suddenly, with the entrance of Bnei Lavan, everything changes. Lavan is sour. The girls realize they've got no more chelek, and they want to leave. But there's one piece left to answer, the trafim. But remember what I told you at the beginning of the shiur, is that in some of the contracts, the household gods were a marker of ownership of the house, or shall we say, ownership of the estate, a holding in the estate. What do the girls say? Ha'od lanu chelek benach benachala beveit avinu. Do we still have some legacy? Do we have some ownership here? Among the many, many shitot about why Rachel stole the trafim, ranging from the homiletic of she wanted to keep her father from Avodah Zarah, to the famous comment of the Radak's father that she took it because she was still involved in Avodah Zarah, the Midrashim that support that, very difficult, of course, is this suggestion, which is that Rachel was taking it not as a religious item, not to prevent Lavan and not to prevent Lavan from finding them, as the Radak himself says, and not in order to do her own worship, as the Midrash suggests, but rather as a claim on the household. Tragically, of course, that is what led to her untimely death, because, of course, when she took the trafim, Lavan came. What did Yaakov take an oath and said? Anyone who has taken the trafim will die. And, of course, Rachel ends up dying tragically as a result. But the rest of this piece, the rest of the parsha, and indeed all the way till the end of the parsha with the treaty sitting, with the treaty scene on the rocks in Galad, and the terms of the treaty, are all things that have echoes and epigraphic evidence that we have from the same time, from the same place. The reason I mention this, and the reason that I wanted to make this the focus of the shiur tonight, is because often people are under the impression that everything that is presented to us from any of the ologies, whether they are philology or Assyriology or Egyptology, and most notably archaeology, it's always going to be something that will challenge, something that will make claims that run counter to our traditional understanding. Such is not the case. Nearly always, that which we find helps us understand the text better and helps us understand the zitzim leben of the text, the environmental context of the text, and helps us understand not only some of the nuances and some of the wording, but indeed the entire fabric of the relationship that is here, that without recourse to understanding the ancient world through the contracts and through the letters and through the records that were kept, that we unearthed, we now, as a result of finding them, we now have a better understanding of what was really going on between Lavan and Yaakov. And we can go back to our original question and answer, that we understand why Rachel, Rivka, and Yitzchak, with great brachot, sent Yaakov to Lavan. Lavan's a fine guy at the beginning. And Lavan is a wealthy guy. And Lavan's going to take care of Yaakov. And Lavan has daughters. And that's great. In the meantime, though, things change back at the ranch. And as a result of that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Yaakov and says, it's time to leave. It's time to come back. It's time to fulfill your netter that you took at Beit El and build that Mizbeach. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbat.